if your job isn't able to be the priority when you're at home working, it's going to reflect, it's going to show. And so I think that, using that as a crutch or an excuse not to go into the office is actually going to end up hurting you in the end. You're not going to be able to be successful.
Good morning, HR. I'm Mike Coffey, and this is the podcast where I talk to business leaders about bringing people together to create value for shareholders, customers, and the community. Please follow, rate, and review Good Morning HR wherever you get your podcast. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, or at goodmorninghr.com. The last Thursday of the month means I'm joined by a friend to discuss timely HR news topics. And this month, I have the privilege of welcoming Karen Cunningham to the pod. Karen is Principal Consultant and President of Intrust HR. She has over 25 years' experience in HR and is a senior-level certified HR professional by both HRCI and SHRM. Welcome to Good Morning HR, Karen.
Thank you. I appreciate you. I love being here.
So layoffs are in the news again. Last week, Tesla laid off about 10% of its global workforce. And according to Crunchbase, over 47,000 tech workers have been laid off in the U.S. so far this year. Now, of course, those are folks who are finding jobs generally pretty quickly. So it's not like we've got 47,000 unemployed tech workers, eating Cheetos on the corner and in their flannels. But there is a trend here where layoffs are happening. But when I read Elon Musk's statement, he put out a statement on X, formerly known as Twitter, saying that about every 5 years, we need to reorganize and streamline the company for the next phase of growth. And when he said that, I remembered back to a Wall Street Journal article from about a month ago, talking about a company, a medical technology company called Hologic, whose CFO said that mass layoffs are a failure of leadership. So what do you think is going on with all these tech layoffs and just layoffs in general? Is this a normal business cycle, or are we really dealing with a failure of leadership?
Well, I would lean towards failure of leadership more. I know sometimes there's a lot of reasons for layoffs. I mean, if there's a shift in the company's focus and there's a department that no longer is needed, those are hard decisions. Those are just decisions you have to make. But if you're reorganizing every 5 years just to make yourself realign, then I believe that is the failure of leadership. Why in the world would you need to wait 5 years to be realigning your company? That should be a continuous improvement process. I also think that we're sending the wrong message to employees when we're telling them that their job is insignificant enough that we are going to go through a rotation just every few years of cycling through them. And if that's the message that we're sending employees, I'm not sure when we're ever going to get back to the point where employees are going to be loyal to us as companies anymore.
Yeah, if they're looking over their shoulder all the time, it's hard to call them engaged, right, if that's really their concern.
But as a company owner, the one thing that they want is employee loyalty. But that's a reciprocal engagement. That's not a blind faith engagement that an employee does for an employer anymore. Our grandparents did that. Because they actually worked for companies they could trust that were going to take care of them through their entire career. But that's not the day and age that we live in today. So what does the company need to do to make sure that they're creating the environment where their employees will feel loyal to them for a long period of time?
And I think employees have learned, and I remember, the light bulb going off in my 20s, early in my corporate career, where I realized, we've got these salary bands here, and they're only going to let me get so much of an increase every year. But if I leave this employment, I can go get that much more money. And, they don't see it as a raise at the new place. And so they're not concerned. And then you can go back to the original company coming in from the outside and go back to where you wanted to work and get the full money. So, so employees, I think for 30 years have known how to game this system. And so I think it's kind of a two-sided thing. And maybe it's an incentives issue on the employer side. How are we structuring our pay? Are we really recognizing the employees that we really most need to keep? And are we incentivizing them to stay and have that stability? But there are, like you said, there are these other issues around like just the dynamics of an economy. Tech companies especially, I know because we work with some of them, those who are in different rounds of venture funding, they get all this cash and they have to do something with the cash. You can't hold on. You got to spend this cash. And so they just start buying stupid stuff and they start investing in employees that they don't need yet. And then when things change or you know, and they constantly are changing their strategies, some of that happens. And most of like Elon Musk companies are pretty, you know, still relatively early stage company. I wouldn't call, you know, Tesla fully mature company there. They're mm-hmm. still trying to figure out how they're going to come to market and with different products. And so some of that stuff's like, I can see, you know, okay, we're going in a different direction. But I think, and I'm not a big fan of the Jack Welch constantly be cutting the bottom 10% of your employees, that whole attitude. But I do think there's something to be said for more aggressive performance management, because if we're honest, most of the time we don't lose anything in our layoff process because who we're really laying off are those employees who we probably didn't manage along the way.
Well, and sometimes the layoff is an easy out to performance management issues that should have been addressed a long time ago. So, yeah. You know, and to your point, the Jack Welch philosophy of the bottom 10%, why are those even employees? And what's wrong with an organization that has employees that are all performing at level, if not higher level? And, you know, I think that type of system automatically assumes the worst in employees and in companies and their leadership.
Right. And Peter Capelli, who's a professor at Wharton, University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, was on the podcast a couple months ago, and he was quoted in that Wall Street Journal article, and he basically said layoffs are often a way of companies covering how lazy they've been about their performance management. And I think especially larger organizations are still on this idea that we manage performance on an annual basis. Once a year, you get a performance review. And that's where you find out how you did the previous 12 months rather than on an ongoing basis managing day-to-day performance and giving, especially these younger workers, they want that constant feedback. They want to know where they stand, what their quality is, what their productivity is, or whatever you're measuring them against. They want that feedback. And I think that we just don't have enough, especially large organizations, who've clued into that. And they're still trying to, you know, HR is still trying to crack the whip to make these frontline managers do performance assessments.
Well, how about, you know, layoffs that are done annually in December mm-hmm. before the fiscal year closes? Again, what kind of morale are you creating in a company when there's a cyclical process to, you know, to your employment, and you're, you know, maybe you've made it through the last seven, but you finally get hit in, you know, round eight of, you know, the constant layoffs that an organization goes through. And we're never going to create loyal employees that way. We've got to find a way that we can actually treat employees like we want to be treated, you know, go back to, and there isn't the same environment that our grandparents had in the workplace. There aren't organizations. The biggest of the best of the companies are vulnerable to acquisitions, mergers, just complete failure. You know, so all those things can happen, and we know that. But if we're trying to create a mutually respectful relationship with our employees, and we're focusing on that continuous performance improvement, you know, really focusing in on what do we need to be doing to coaching this employee through the life cycle of their employment? And if things aren't going well, what are we doing to make sure they're aware of it, to let them have an opportunity to succeed or to let them know if they're failing? And a lot of times the employee knows it. And that's the argument I get from managers often is, well, you know, I can do this 30-day performance improvement plan, but they're failing anyway, you know. Well, you don't know that. What opportunity have you given them to let them know that this is the expectation that's been created, and either you need to fulfill these obligations within the next 30 days or your employment is at jeopardy? And how many companies think they've done that, but then when the employee gets terminated, they're surprised? So, and I can't even count the number of times that process has happened. And so if that's the case, then we aren't doing what we need to do in performance management. And I find a lot of that, honestly, is just natural tendency to avoid conflict. Mm-hmm. Managers don't enjoy it. They want to coach to the process, to the systems, but to deal with behavioral issues in particular, it's hard. It's really hard. And it's easier for them to just kind of skirt past it and keep, you know, driving the, you know, the widgets, the number of widgets that you're producing versus dealing with why the quality of the widgets isn't there or how many people that person just bulldozed in the process of creating their widgets, you know, that they did while they're doing that. So, you know, to me, we're losing focus on the wrong, we're changing focus on the wrong things, if that's the right way to say it. And by doing so, we're failing the employee and we're failing the company.
Yeah. And that employee who wants to do the job well and has the behaviors we want, those two things cover a multitude of sins. I mean, if I've got an employee who wants to be here, wants to be successful and has the right attitude, to think about just laying that employee off or just not dealing with performance issues and just waiting to see what happens, that doesn't even occur to me, because this is somebody I'm going to invest in. And I don't think we see management and leadership as an investment in those employees. You know, we too often, you know, we see frontline supervisors, especially, who say, here's what the standards are. You have to figure out how to do it. And I think they use the excuse that, well, everybody wants independence. They want autonomy. So I'm not going to tell them how to do their job, you know, but if they don't meet the standards. But that's not what that was ever about. You know, that autonomy we talk about with employee engagement. Those managers need to make the investment to give those employees the tools. So if you have to fire somebody or terminate them or let, you know, use the ruse of a layoff to exit them from the organization, you should be able to say, I did everything I can to help that employee be successful. And despite their best efforts and mine, it didn't work. And sometimes that's the case. Jobs change, technology changes, and people sometimes can't adapt. And I think we're going to see more and more of that with AI, where, you know, I use the example a lot of times. You may have 3 HR reps in your organization right now, and after you implement some of these new technologies, you may only need 1. But that doesn't mean you want to get rid of those other 2. Maybe you need to find, you know, upskill them, find a lateral position in another department that they, you know, that they can excel at, and really keep those people sticky to your organization. But that's an investment, and mm-hmm. that's an investment that you feel like I can put a dollar sign to. You know, I can say, you know, if I send them this training and it's going to cost me X dollars, versus we don't have any reliable metrics that your management's going to accept about what does it cost when we hire our next employee to train them, to onboard them, to take some, you know, some percentage of failure rates with the hiring. What's all of that going to cost versus taking somebody we know who loves this company and who likes working here and has been acceptable and just retraining them to do the new job?
Yeah. And giving them an opportunity to figure out what's their passion, where's that career path, you know, for that person as well. I mean, you know, you talk about even a smaller organization too, there's not going to be layers of positions and levels that are naturally stacked upon each other. It's going to take sometimes some more creative thinking in terms of this person's skill sets could be transferable over here. Or a lot of times it's, what are we doing as a department? What do we need to do differently? You were talking about, you know, HR in particular. How many HR professionals are dealing with the day-to-day tactical aspects of HR and not able to really focus on being a business partner, a true business partner, getting in there and figuring out how you produce what you produce or why your employees focus on certain things each day. I mean, really understanding the business and how to partner with them so that the things that you're doing in HR are backing up the business. And if AI has taken over part of that, that's great. But that just means you've got more time to put your feet on the ground and go walk around and learn from the people that you're serving within your, you know, within your organization and figure out how you can serve them better. And I think that even by doing that, you know, the expansion of the role just naturally occurs.
And I think very few of us got into HR so that we could explain benefits to employees over and over, answer the same dumb benefits questions over and over again. None of us do, you know, or process payroll changes after the fact, you know, and those are things AI will resolve for us. And those are the things that AI is going to really make, and they're going to free us up. And whatever, whether it's HR, accounting, you know, wherever in the organization you are, I think that AI is really going to free people up to do their best and highest work. And that's not what we're talking about, but I can't have any conversation lately without stumbling into AI. I just spoke at the North Dallas Chambers HR conference last week on a panel about AI. And I just think, you know, it's going to lead to some upheaval, but an employer should start planning now. And one of the things they said at that Hologic company in the Wall Street Journal article was, you know, if a leader comes and says, I need to hire a new person, they immediately say, go look at your lowest performer there. How can you offshore, send that work to somebody else or get that work done some other way? And then, so we're at a net zero gain if we hire somebody else and we move that employee someplace else or exit them from the group. But I also thought it was interesting because Hologic created COVID test. And so their business exploded in 2020, 2021. And they didn't hire any new people. They have about 7,000 employees. But I thought the interesting thing was, I was really skeptical because how do you scale and ramp up at that high, at that level, and still do all your shipping operations and all of that and not add any headcount before or after something, you know, this giant boom of business. And what they ultimately, when you read deep enough in the article, it was, oh, they hired a lot of temps. And so now, okay, so you're still adding FTEs. They're not your FTEs, but you're still paying for labor and you're still bringing people in. Do you have an opinion about, you know, the balance between your regular employees and your temp employees coming through an agency and how employers ought to balance those things?
Well, yeah, I actually think that most of them should be your core, should be with your internal employees, mainly because, again, from a culture perspective, when you're building an organization's culture and you're really instilling the values and, you know, the principles in which we want to operate, when you have an individual who's working with you but doesn't have the commitment of an actual full-time job, then how are they going to engage at the same level as someone who knows that you've invested in them for full-time employment? And I mean the temporary staffing to me really should be utilized when there's a need that isn't going to be ongoing. There's a ramp up and it's going to last for 6 months, a year, possibly even. But it's going to go down after that. And you don't want to hire full-time staff just so that you can then lay off half of them a year from now or 6 months from now. But there is a cost associated with it that needs to be factored in as well. But from a, you know, from an employee culture perspective, I think that if you're investing in them as an employee from the very beginning or as close to it as you can, once you've identified where those full-time needs are going to exist, then why not just convert them over and help them be part of the team? I admittedly have worked for very few extremely large companies. It's intentional. It was never something I wanted to do. I worked for a couple of them and it reminded me why I didn't want to do it. because I just didn't work well in an extremely regimented environment where individual creativity and decision-making really wasn't part of what I could do. And maybe I was just with the wrong organizations. And that is quite possibly the case. But within those organizations, you know, there is a larger tendency to use temp staffing at a much higher level. And I'm not sure if that's a financial decision that they're making so that on the books, the full-time labor cost looks different. If that's the reason why, or, you know, if there's other factors to consider. But, you know, from an engagement standpoint, I do believe there's a point where there's going to be an impact that the workforce is going to feel differently and there's going to be an effect to that.
And if you have long-term temps, the people working alongside them don't view them as temps after a while. And so you're going to have the same negative effect when you tell the agency, quit sending this person, because you still got this gap and people are still going to be concerned about somebody that they've worked alongside and cared about. And so I think there's a place for that short-term temp. But if you think this is going to be a boom for 6 months or a year even, I think bring them in and maybe, you know, bring them in through an agency. And if they really excel after 90 days, bring them on. But that may lead you to a layoff down the road. But it's a net effect either way, because you've got people that you've invested in, you've trained at some level, and they're still exiting out. What I did like about the Hologic thing is being very cautious in hiring, because I see, I've just seen it too often in when I was in corporate America, and I've seen it with our clients over the years. And I, especially on the background screening side of my business, I love it when my clients hire a lot of people. But sometimes I see, I know enough about their business and I see a big bump in hiring, and I talk to them, you get some new contracts or nothing? Oh no, we got new budget. And I'm like, well, I'm glad to take my share of your budget, but I'm not sure that's necessarily the, just pouring more people into the organization without a real strategy about how you're going to use them and where you can immediately start to leverage their skills is always the best plan. Mm-hmm. And let's take a quick break. If you're an HRCI or SHRM certified professional, this episode of Good Morning HR has been pre-approved for 1.5 hour of recertification credit. To obtain the recertification information, visit goodmorninghr.com and click on Recert Credits. Then select episode 145 and enter the keyword Cunningham. That's CUNNINGHAM. And if you're looking for even more recertification credit, check out the webinars page at imperativeinfo.com. Good Morning HR is brought to you by Imperative, bulletproof background checks with fast and friendly service. For 25 years, Imperative has helped risk-averse clients make well-informed decisions about the people they involve in their business. Whether that means very thorough pre-employment background checks, due diligence for family offices or private equity firms, or any other kind of business transaction, if there are people involved, there's risk involved. We help businesses mitigate that risk. You can learn more at imperativeinfo.com. And now back to my conversation with Karen Cunningham. So the other big topic continues to be this. I think 2024 is the year of the return to office tug of war. And there's all these studies out there, and it just depends on who does the study and what. And most of these studies aren't academic studies. They're studies by people selling a product. And so I'm always skeptical because I go look at what they're actually selling, and you're like, oh, I see why they skewed the study this way. But companies are trying to lure their employees back to their cubicles, and some are resisting. And then there's a company called Live Career. They did a survey. That doesn't totally surprise me, but it said 43% of workers say they're more afraid of working in an office full time for the rest of their careers than losing their romantic relationship or getting a divorce. And I thought, well, the word fear here, I mean, I don't think I'm going to get a divorce. So I don't have, so if you ask me, which are you more, afraid of, having to go work in an office or, I'm more afraid of having to go work in an office if that's not what I want to do, because I'm not worried about my marriage. My wife is extremely patient, so I'm not worried about my marriage falling apart. So I think the word fear is a little bit strong there. But I do see that there's still that really cautious approach from employees about going back to the office. What are you seeing when you're talking to your clients about that?
No, I agree. I mean, it is tug of war is the perfect description of it. I think one of the challenges is some of the companies that proved to be successful with a remote workplace that had a culture of everyone has to come in the office no matter what, but it proved that it worked. And now that we're back to where, we are in 2024, far enough away from the pandemic that we're not, fearful daily of our lives, but for our lives. But, if you look at where we are now, some of these organizations have forgotten how productive their workplace was in 2020, and how these independent contributors who do things like marketing or especially IT have been able to be really productive at home.
Right.
And a lot of those individuals are people that need focus time and need creative time. They need time where they can actually just focus on what they're working on and not have the interruptions of an office. The flip side to that is, where's the collaboration? Where's the connectivity with coworkers? Where's the connectivity with the company? How do you create that environment? When I think about myself in my 20s. This is another component of it too. I learned so much, not by the work I was doing, but by the work that my coworkers were doing down the hall, and by me having a natural curiosity to go down and just ask, so tell me what this is with this comp ratio that you're working on, or, you know, a merit matrix, or, you know, I knew nothing about compensation and compensation planning, but I got to sit in the compensation manager's office enough, or even just go to lunch with her, to just learn enough to have a foundation of what that looks like. Same thing with the benefits manager, areas that I didn't work on day to day, but I wouldn't have had that opportunity if I wasn't down the hall from them and just had that casual interaction, that casual opportunity to learn from a coworker. And I don't think we can create that same environment when everyone's working remote. So there's a balance. There's a, you know, how do you allow people the independent time to focus and get work done? And maybe even just a little bit of flexibility in the traffic and, you know, just life activities and things. You know, how do you balance that with the other piece of it, the collaboration, the cross-training, the growth, and the connectivity with the company? How do you balance those? And I really do think that where possible, a hybrid environment tends to work better because you're able to provide them with both. You've got, you know, the opportunity to work independently, but then there's connection days. There's automatic days every week when everyone has to go in. And if there's going to be meetings, team meetings, then it's on those days where everyone can be in the same room, not in a Zoom meeting together where half the people are trying to figure out their connectivity or their cameras off because they're actually really busy with something else instead. Right. But, you know, where's that balance? And I think that's still where we're struggling.
And, you know, it's interesting because my oldest is about to turn 25. He graduated from UT with an engineering degree a few years ago and works for a large employer here locally. And I talked to him and his friends. And I also, you know, I teach yoga, and I'm teaching yoga with a lot of 20-somethings. And most of them want to be in the office because they're recognizing they're not getting mentoring. If they're remote, they're not building those relationships. They're not getting that water cooler kind of just learning things through osmosis and being in an environment. And I think they're realizing that. I think the people that are really pushing back now, just from talking to clients and anecdotal stuff from my circles, is that it's that mid-level career professional is who's really pushing back. And I think it's a mistake for them probably too, in a lot of circumstances, because we do have, you know, there are, you know, whether we recognize them or not, there's always going to be a bias for the people we worked with in person most recently. If I'm a leader and I'm looking for my next, you know, right-hand person, it's very likely it's going to be somebody I'm working with on a more closely daily basis, one-to-one. And even if you're a better producer, better, you know, potential leader, but you're remote and we only talk once a week on a 15-minute Zoom call, you're probably not going to have that level of credibility. And I think, you know, there's some of that. But, you know, we're a fully remote company. I sold my office building. I mean, I don't, you know, I've got employees all over the place now. But one thing I found is that to keep myself accountable as a leader, we just did our quarterly planning session last week. And I realized that I'm, as the leader, losing connection with my team at the level that I need it, because I'm the ADD guy. They're all real focused, you know, but I get busy and haven't been making, especially the last 6 months, that intentional investment in connecting directly with them. And so to make that happen, once a month, we do a one-to-one every week, but once a month, that one-to-one is going to be in person. We're going to go to lunch, and then we're going to go sit down back to the conference room that that we've replaced our whole office with is one conference room now, and work an afternoon together. And that way, I'm going to get that deeper connection, better understanding what's going on, and not be sitting here as, and I'm the one who's forever distractible. And, you know, my employees can be as focused as they want to. So I think sometimes from the leader point of view, maybe we need to think more about, even if we've got a remote workplace, how do we connect back in more often? And I, you know, so any idea, what are you telling leaders about how to be better leaders in a remote environment?
Well, the good news is you're doing a lot of it. So congratulations. But, you know, the one-on-ones, I can't tell you how many managers forget to have one-on-ones, completely forget, and then wonder why they don't know what's going on with their employee 3 months later. But one-on-one meetings, you know, finding an opportunity to connect with someone and just visit. Hey, how are things going? You know, just, I see you're working on this project. Tell me how it's going. You know, just what you would do in the office, but being intentional in those connections and finding a way to build those relationships, but in a remote way. It's not as easy. You do have to think more of it. And I totally get you on the ADD part because my mind is jumping in, you know, 20 different directions throughout the day. And so trying to actually remember, oh yeah, I should pause and take time and actually find out from my employees how their day's going, you know, what they're up to. Hey, how did that cheer competition go for your daughter last weekend? Again, the things that we would, you know, find an opportunity to idly connect with in the office, how can we do that whenever we're remote? And so I think those are a lot of the key points. Also just being connected on our objectives and what we're working on and knowing what someone's doing well in and what they might be struggling in and finding coaching opportunities and ways that we can, you know, provide some additional investment in them and their development and their growth. I do agree with you. I think the 20-something-year-olds, a lot of them live in apartments by themselves. Yeah. So if they aren't in an office, then they're not seeing anyone all day long. And so I think they're craving that, some of them, not all, are craving that social interaction. And whenever you get to be, you know, that mid-professional, you've got the spouse, you've got the children. What I find one of the mistakes.
Both of which are reasons I would want to go to the office, but okay.
Right? Yeah. But, you know, one of the mistakes that I think employees have made is taking advantage of that situation and making the excuse that they can't come into the office because they don't have childcare. Well, how are you getting your job done every day? Because I've raised two kids and I remember how much work they were. And if someone isn't able to help you, and I understand there's financial considerations and everything else, but if your job isn't able to be the priority when you're at home working, it's going to reflect, it's going to show. And so I think that, you know, using that as a crutch or an excuse not to go into the office is actually going to end up hurting you in the end. You're not going to be able to be successful.
Have you seen this overemployed trend? There's a whole subreddit on it about people who went remote in 2020, 2021. And took two full-time jobs. And, you know, I'm in most cases kind of like shame on the employer for not, you know, measuring productivity and making sure that you're utilizing, you know, this employee at a higher level. But, you know, they're juggling two jobs remote and they don't know. I've had several clients call me up and say, how do we figure out if somebody's working someplace else? Because we're concerned about that. And one recently found out through a LinkedIn post that one of their key technology employees was working for a direct competitor, just because, and that's only because the company he's working for posted a LinkedIn thing welcoming him to the company. and there's a whole subreddit about these people who are doing this. And there was a story in Business Insider recently about a guy who was doing that and pulling down about $225,000 a year, doing his main job plus a second job that was only worth about $80,000. And he hated that boss, but it was an extra $80,000 and he didn't have to work too hard. So I think, you know, I don't know if you have thoughts on that other than making sure you've got policies on it and that you're measuring, you know, how much of your employees' time you're really utilizing.
Well, after I get over the shock and bewilderment of the fact that someone would actually do that, because again, the moral compass on that one is really low if you're going to be, you know, working for two companies full time at the same time. Now, there's people who work a day job, a night job.
Oh, sure.
Those things can work. But working two full time jobs during the day, I actually ran into someone at an HR conference about 2 years ago, and we were just standing in line together to get our lunch. Never had met him before that day, before that moment. And he just casually tells me that he's working for two different companies. and that one of them was going to figure it out eventually because he had to pick one of them to list on his LinkedIn profile as the employer, and he couldn't list both. And so he said the one that he didn't list, you know, he was concerned that eventually they were going to figure it out. And he was a recruiter. And,
Yeah. And so, that is a time-intensive job that really takes, you know, if you're doing that well, you're investing every minute you've got into sourcing candidates.
But he had no shame in it whatsoever. He was just, I mean, I didn't ask. I mean, I forget how it even came out of his mouth, but he just freely shared that, you know, that this is what he was doing. And I looked at him and I said, well, I have a feeling that's going to cause a problem at some point. And he said, well, yeah, I guess it might. But he, you know, it didn't affect him. And I thought, wow, this is not a good sign of where we're going. And again, what does that say to companies who are already fearful of this work from home environment? And what can we do as individual contributors? What can we do as humans to, you know, to help that greater cause and make sure that we're doing things the right way so that companies will see that we can, you know, be trusted and be productive and not take advantage and, you know, all those things by being able to work from home. And I think that's, you know, probably why we're seeing some of the trends we're seeing.
And I'll in the show notes, I'm going to put a link to that Reddit subgroup for overemployed, because if you're a people leader at all, it will make your eyes roll. It's kind of crazy what people at least claim to be doing on there. But that's all the time we have, Karen. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
And thank you for listening. You can comment on this episode or search our previous episodes at goodmorninghr.com or on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. And don't forget to follow us wherever you get your podcast. Rob Upchurch is our technical producer, and you can reach him at robmakespods.com. And thank you to Imperative's marketing coordinator, Marianne Hernandez, who keeps the trains running on time. And I'm Mike Coffey, as always. Don't hesitate to reach out if I can be of service to you personally or professionally. I'll see you next week, and until then, be well, do good, and keep your chin up.